There was, well, first let me tell you about this place. This is one of my favourite places on the planet. This is not in Africa, not in England, not in Norway. This is in a little place called Kirkjulekkort, which is in Iceland. And I've spent a long time in this building. This is the little church that's also a conference centre. You can't see out of the picture. Up this way, there's they've now built a hall for 3,000 people. This is where Hendrik was the pastor for many years. But this place, really, it's just out in the middle of the countryside. You know, it's fields all around. There's no town there. It's just a church on a farm. And the story of it goes that years ago, in the early days of the Pentecostal movement, the few Pentecostals that existed in Iceland wanted to have a summer convention, because that's what you did in those days. So from the big smoke, you know, the big city Reykjavik, they found a farmer who was willing to let them come on their land and have their summer convention. He said, well, I don't have, you know, anything grand, but there's a little shed just where those two buildings were. There used to be an old car garage. And he said, you can have your summer convention in my shed if you want, and you can camp on my farm. And so the first Pentecostals, about 20 people, you know, they got planks and put them on old oil barrels as the seats. And they had the convention here in this place. And the farmer wasn't a believer, but he loved the meeting so much, the singing, the preaching, the power, the presence of God, that he gave his life to the Lord. And he said, more than anything else, I want to have a church, a Pentecostal church in my place. And so he, with his two teenage sons, determined that they were going to build a church. And they were just poor farmers. They weren't very rich. You know, there was no pastor. There was no congregation. But they loved so much to sing and to be in the presence of God that they thought they'd build a little church. And so, you know, they gathered the wood. They started to build. And in their spare time, when they weren't farming and looking after the cars, because it was, as I said, a little garage for the countryside, they built this church. And they just got it up to roof level when there was a disaster. You know, it was in the early days of electricity, and something sparked, and the whole place burnt down to the ground. Ashes, nothing left, all the timbers gone. All, you know, they just put their personal money into it, and it was all burnt to the ground. And they were so discouraged, you know, because they spent so long doing it, and it was such a big job, cost so much money. But they encouraged themselves that we want a house of God here. We want to worship. We want to have the presence of God. So they started again. And they just built it up to the roof level, put the roof on, and a huge storm came, like sometimes happens in Iceland, 140 mile an hour winds, and it blew the whole thing away. It disappeared, gone, nothing left. And this old farmer and his two sons, you know, they were so discouraged. There was no one helping them. It was just them and their money and their work. And after a while, they said to each other, well, let's just try one more time. Perhaps God will be with us and help us. And we want so much to have a house of God in this place. So they tried one more time. And this is the building they built, this one here, that church, that chapel. And it's still there to this day. And it's a beautiful place on the inside. And for many years, God has been worshipped, and around that grew a Bible school. That's where the National Bible School is based, and then a big conference centre with beds for, I don't know, 150 people in a big auditorium for 3,000 people in that place. And it's a wonderful story, really, of, you know, what happens if you really set your heart on building something for God and the worship of God and the presence of God. And, oh, we've lost the, it won't click. There we go. No, it'll come in a minute. but there's a psalm that's, yeah, there we go, that touched me in the week. Psalm 132, and it says this: Lord, remember David and all his self-denial. He swore an oath to the Lord. He made a vow to the Mighty One of Jacob. I will not enter my house or go to my bed. I will not allow sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids till I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling place for the Mighty One of Jacob. That's commitment, isn't it? Perhaps I should start working through the night and not sleeping. But, I mean, that says something about his, you know, the intensity of his desire, that he was desperate to see a place built for the worship of God. And this psalm comes at a particular time in history. You can read about that time in 2 Samuel chapter 7. It says that after the king was settled in his palace, and the Lord had given him rest from all the enemies around him, he said to Nathan his prophet, "Here I am living in a house of cedar, while the ark of the Lord remains in a tent." So David's life up to that point really had been a roller coaster, you know, different crises and amazing things happened. First he slew Goliath, and then he was taken into the king's court, and before long he was commander of Saul's army, and then shortly afterwards he was chased out by Saul, and he was living from hand to mouth in the wilderness, and people started coming to him, and he gathered a little army around him, and Saul was pursuing him, trying to kill him, chasing him from pillar to post, and finally he fled and lived among the Philistines. His life hadn't been very normal up until this point. And then, you know, Saul died and David came, and gradually he started taking over more and more of the country. There was a civil war between the house of Saul and David. And finally, he ends up, you know, Saul's house, you know, is defeated, and David becomes the king. And he makes Jerusalem his capital. Finally, he's at peace. Finally, he can do what he really wanted to do in his life. And that's the moment when he said, "Here I am. I'm living in this nice house. I've got everything I need. But God, I want to build a house for you. In fact, this is so important to me. I'm not going to think about anything else. I'm not going to, you know, take rest or luxury for myself. I'm going to put all of my energy and life into building a house for you." That was his greatest heart's desire. I just want to ask you a question. What is your greatest heart's desire? If you could do one thing or accomplish one thing in your life, what would it be? I like the old jokes, you know, about the genies in a bottle, and I'm sure you have all heard the story of three men stranded on a desert island, and this bottle washes up, and when they uncap it, a genie pops out. There's a Englishman, Scotsman, and Irishman. You shouldn't really tell these jokes these days, should you? But I'm a bit old-fashioned, and the Englishman, you know, the genie goes, "Oh, you can each have a wish." And so the Englishman goes, "Oh, I don't like being on this desert island. I wish I was back home with my wife and kids." And instantly he vanished. And the Scotsman, he thinks, "Well, I love my country, you know, Scotland. It's so beautiful. I love to be able to walk in the glens and the mountains and drink my whiskey. I wish that I was back home in Scotland." So he disappears. And the Irishman, he thinks for a little while, and looks around and he goes, I'm kind of lonely here without my friends. I wish they were back here with me. But I don't know what you would wish for. If you won the lottery, what would you do? Or perhaps to put it in more spiritual terms, if God said to you, there's one prayer that I'm going to answer. Imagine if an angel appeared to you, like he did to Solomon, didn't he? In a dream, this angel came to Solomon and he goes, ask me for anything you want. I think I've got that one up on the screen. Ask me anything for the Lord and I will do it. What would you ask for? Well, this is what Solomon asked. He said, God, I'm just a child, you know, I've become king, I'm here among this great people, I don't know how to lead them. Give me a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. He was asking for God to help him work for God, help him in his work. Help him to be wise and a good leader of the people. Well, when you think about Solomon, he was a great king, wasn't he? You think about Solomon's achievements, you know, God really gave him wisdom. And if you read the book 1 Kings, the first few chapters describe all the amazing things that Solomon did. You know, he built this amazing palace. He built the temple. He built Jerusalem up to be one of the most beautiful cities on the earth at that time. He was so wise. Kings came from all over to find audience from him. And he had so much money. Because of his wisdom, he was able to accumulate great wealth. This is what it says about him in the Bible. King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift, articles of silver and gold, robes, weapons, spices, horses and mules. Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses, which he kept in the chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. The king made silver and gold as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt. That sounds amazing, doesn't it? Don't you think so? Amazing, you know, all this stuff, all this wisdom, all this people, all this honor. Now, I just want to ask you a question. How many of you think that what Solomon did was good? And all this stuff that we've read about there, that verse there, how many of you think that is good? Put your hands up. And the alternative is, how many of you think it's bad? To have all this stuff like that, is that good? Is that a sign of God's favour? Do you think? Now, you all know this is a trick question, don't you? Is it good or is it bad? I think a lot of people would say, well, this is good. I mean, God is blessing me and all this stuff, all this money, all this riches. I actually don't think it's good. And my reason for saying that is because there's one little passage that probably none of you know or know very much in the book of Deuteronomy. And it's a few verses that are called the laws for the king. And in the law of Moses, there was actually these few verses that said, you know, in the future you're going to get a king. And there are actually seven different laws, seven things that the king has to be and do and not to do. So here are some of the things that it says about the laws for the king. The king must not acquire a great number of horses for himself.
Yeah, it depends on whether the horses were for himself
They were for in that verse we said there, Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. The horses were, I think, they're for himself. Okay. He must not take many wives. Well, we read that Solomon had many wives. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. He must not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites. And then when he becomes king, he must write for himself on a scroll a copy of the law and read it every day. In other words, just to make sure you've not read any of the law, you have to copy it yourself, every word from beginning to end, and then read a portion of it every day. So he had no excuse. He must have written that little passage, what a king should do and what God wanted a king to be like. And he lived in a very different way from how God wanted the king to be. And I think that although what Solomon asked for from God was good, it wasn't the best thing. It says in that passage that God was pleased that he hadn't asked for wealth or, you know, long life for himself or health. God was pleased he hadn't asked for those things. But Solomon's heart, you know, the most important thing in his life was the work of God, what he did. His, you know, all this building and all the judgments and things like that. And the trouble is, if you make the work of God the most important thing in your life, sooner or later something will go wrong. We're not created to be workers of God. We're created to be lovers of God, sons and daughters of God. If you make the work of God the most important thing in your life, you'll end up with a heart that is bored. Because work doesn't satisfy you in the deepest level. You know, you might at times be elated because of success, frustrated because of difficulties, or discouraged because of failures, but it doesn't fill your heart in the way that God has designed a heart to be. And so because of that, you end up looking for satisfaction somewhere else, like Solomon did. He accumulated money, horses, women. You know, he looked other places to get the meaning in his life. And his relationship with God was, I'd call it, professional. And I know for a lot of Christian leaders, you know, their relationship with God is like a professional relationship. You know, they know God, they know how to get a word, they know how to pray, they know how to live with God. But it's years since they really worship God with all of their hearts. Since they really encountered God. God isn't the first love of their heart, but it's this professional and shallow relationship. Nobody would say about Solomon that he was a man who knew God, who encountered God. It's interesting that Solomon, he was the one that built the temple in the end, because God said to David, you can't build it, you've killed too many people, your son will build it. Solomon spent 7 years building the temple. That's quite a long time, isn't it? He had thousands of people. But still, it took them 7 years. And yet, it took him 13 years to build his own palace. That says something about his priorities and about his heart. Another interesting verse in 1 Kings 9:25 says this: 3 times a year, Solomon sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings on the altar he'd built for the Lord, and so fulfilled all the temple's obligations. So you could read that and say, well, that's good. Solomon's doing all that he has to do. He's fulfilling the obligations. He's making these big sacrifices 3 times a year. Or you could look at it, I think, like God does. And I wonder if God is going, well, you know, he kept his obligations. He did what he had to do, but his heart was really in a different place. When we look at the life of David, God judges David very differently. Because God wrote of David twice in Scripture that David was a man after God's own heart. Before David did any of the things for which he's famous, before he even killed Goliath, before he was chosen as, you know, by Samuel, before he led the armies of Israel, before he built Jerusalem, before any of that, God looked at him and he goes, "Here's a man after my own heart." And interestingly, 1,000 years after he died, in the book of Acts, God looked back over his life and he goes, "Here's someone who did all that I asked. He's a man after my own heart." Even after, you know, the failings, after falling with Bathsheba and counting the fighting men and the many things he did wrong, because David wasn't perfect. You know, he also took many wives and did many wrong things. But somehow his heart was burning for God. He's a man after God's own heart. That's probably the highest compliment that God could give anyone. Because the heart of God is the heart of the universe. That's where life flows out of. That's the great source that gives us life. You know, it wraps us in the love that sustains us from day to day. The heart of God is the plumb line against which all other hearts are mentioned. And when we're finally judged in heaven's courts, the things that we've done, our life, it won't be assessed by what it looks like. Not by how many things we've accumulated, or what a big congregation we've got, or how many people have been impressed with us. But it's according to what is in our hearts, what our heart was like. And on Judgment Day, I'm sure, and the Bible tells us that many that are first now will be last. There'll be people that seem to have done great deeds, people who have been regarded as important people, spiritual in the eyes of others. God looks at them and he goes, "Actually, they were shallow and selfish, motivated by ambition or pride, because they never really had that deep relationship with God in their hearts." The two things that we'll be judged by on that day: how much did you love God? Did you love him with all of your heart and mind, all of your strength and all of your soul? And did you love your neighbor as you love yourself? So David, he had an impressive array of things that he'd done. You know, if you list his achievements, what he did, you know, the great king, conquered all the enemies, built Jerusalem, established the nation, many things. But God looks at him and he goes, "Actually, that's not important to me. What's important to me about him was that he was a man after my own heart." David's identity and his personal fulfillment, what he lived for, was, "I'm a lover and I'm loved by God. That's who I am." Like that song we were singing, "You're a good father, that's who you are, and I'm loved by you." You know, that was what David lived for. And that was why he could write, you know, "I'm not going to take any rest until I've built this wonderful house for the Lord." The one thing that David asked for, he actually states it in one of the Psalms, Psalm 27. He says, oh no, it's not that one. He says this: "One thing I ask from the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple." That's what David would have asked if the angel came to him and goes, "You can have anything from God. What do you want?" That's what David would have said. "I just want to worship God. I just want to sit in the presence and be with him." That was why he was such a great king. Because he wasn't living to be king. That was why he was such a great warrior. It wasn't because he hated his enemies or he had ambition to expand his country. It was just because he was burning for passion for the Lord. He could stand before Goliath and say, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that defies the living God?" He was burning with passion for God, and so his life made sense. He wasn't bored, he was not unfulfilled, but his life was successful and happy. I love the Psalms, and I love some of the things that David wrote in the Psalms. You know, the Psalms, when David wrote a lot of them, he was just a teenage boy, a teenage shepherd that nobody knew about. He didn't think he was writing a poem that would later be read by millions of people in the Bible. You know, it was just like, here's 14, 15-year-old David, teenage boys with their poetry about their emotions. You know, that's what he was doing. And he was writing about his experiences with God. Here's one of them. "How precious is your unfailing love." This is what David experienced. This is what he was living in. "I feast on the abundance of your house. You give me drink from your rivers of delight. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light." Another psalm, a well-known one, Psalm 63. "O God, you are my God, earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there's no water. I have seen you in the sanctuary. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you." So this is David writing about his personal experiences with God, because that was his experience. His life was successful. Because he met God like that, he could do the things that he did. Because he was burning for God, he longed to build a house. Interestingly, when he said to God, I want to build a house for you, the prophet Nathan went to God and asked God, is this okay? And God said to him, actually, no, he can't build a house for you. And there's a long passage, long prophetic word from God. The interesting thing is that God goes, no, you can't build a house for me, but I'm going to build a house for you. And one of your sons will sit on your throne and you'll have a kingdom. You'll establish a nation that will always be before me. So David burned to build a house for God, and God goes, no, I'm going to build a house for you. You know, if you really want to see something great come through your life, it won't come because you work hard. It won't come because you're clever or because God has given you wisdom. It won't come as God blesses your work. It will come out of your heart. It says in Proverbs, above all else, guard your heart, because that's the wellspring of life. Anything that comes from your life that is life, eternal life to other people, it has to come out of that place of relationship with God. You know, it comes as the Holy Spirit meets with your desire, you know, and the fruitfulness comes from that. So really, it's just a challenge that I want to leave you with. What is the desire of your heart? Are you like David, that can honestly say, if that angel came, the one thing I want is, I just want to sit with God. I just want to know him more. I just want to worship him. I want time to be with him and to love him. If not, then we need to work on our hearts. We need to seek God and spend that time asking him to soften our hearts. Because if our heart is in a different place, then everything else will come out slightly crooked, like it did with Solomon. There might be many good things, but at the end of the day, when God looks at your life, he won't be looking at the good things. he'll be looking at the love and the worship of your heart. So that's the key thing to work on. And for us as a church, that's the key thing for us to grow in. And that's why we're building this house of prayer then. You know, I hope and pray and expect that God will use that house of prayer to help us as a church really grow more and more into his heart. Amen.